I'm going to call the Joint Public Safety Finance Division, Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee to order. This, the agenda today, we will have two items today, which is the presentation on the Corrections Strategic Management and Operations Advisory Task Force Report. And then we'll also, we have Adam Walsh? Do we have the Adam Walsh?
No.
So that will be the extent of our hearing this morning. And obviously, this, if some of these recommendations were adopted, they would have policy implications for the Department of Corrections as well as have a financial impact on DOC. We will be, on Thursday, we will, Mr. Carter will give a presentation on the governor's budget, and we will start our hearings with a hearing from the commissioner from the Department of Corrections. And then we have the rest of the day Thursday, and then Tuesday we have scheduled for DOC also, and we'll just keep going through the budgets under our division. So, Representative Hillstrom, do you have anything you want to add here? Or shall we?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I thought we were going to do the Adam Walsh Act today, but apparently there's some problem with that. So this is all that's on our agenda. So, Mr. Kane, Mr. Peterson, I don't know who else from the task force. I think everybody was invited to attend, but you were chairing the task force, as I understand it. Mr. Peterson is from the, is he here?
He's here.
Were you going to present also, or no? Maybe you'd still want to come up and tell us what your role was. Mr. Peterson is with the management and budget. And in fact, why don't you start off, Mr. Peterson, just sort of, because we asked you, we asked just a little background. We asked at the end of the legislative session during conference committee when we were having seemingly endless debates with the Department of Corrections over their budget, that we were asked whether it wouldn't make some sense to do something similar that the Department of Transportation did a couple of years ago and do sort of an analysis of the DOC budget from an outsider's perspective with people, with various people from various backgrounds. So that's, can you just say a little bit about your process in this, and then we'll have Mr. Kane talk about the specifics.
Certainly. Excuse me. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Peterson, and I work for Management Analysis and Development out of the Office, Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. And if you look at page 51 in the report, that is the legislation that created the Corrections Strategic Management and Operations Advisory Task Force. The task force had its initial meeting in September and ended its session last Thursday, February 11th. There were a total of 10 meetings, some of them up to a full day, full eight-hour day in length. A majority of them usually extended about 4-5 hours. We started out with the process by having the department review its operations. We also toured the Stillwater facility, and then we looked at what the task force identified as key ways to improve the efficiency in corrections and reduce the inmate per diem for the Department of Corrections. And those responses, those ideas became the primary focus for the task force for roughly about its last three meetings, which then concluded in the report that you have here in front of you. The task force was made up of 15 members. Membership represented various areas of academia, business, government, and fields of expertise included corrections, strategic and operational improvement, quantitative analysis, financial management, law enforcement, labor relations, chemical dependency treatment, and related programs, a laundry list of expertise that was inside the task force. That was the primary background. The process was built similar to a process that was used roughly a year ago when the legislature generated a transportation strategic management and operations advisory task force, and they brought a product back to the legislature roughly 1 year ago. I think it's almost close to being 1 year ago, the early part of February, last of January. So that is that. Do you have any additional questions as far as the background?
Maybe this question will come later because I want Mr. Keane to go through all this. But wait a minute. I just want to know from your perspective because this idea to have a small group of people in a relatively small period of time look at a billion-dollar operation and then report back on efficiency strategies. Is this really in the future, given that, you know, this does cost money to put something like this together? Is this the way that the legislature should be? Because we can't do it. We rely on the Department of Corrections and our fiscal staff to analyze the operation as best they can and give us their best judgment on what we should or shouldn't do. But is this idea of constructing a advisory group or a task force or working group, is this a good thing for the legislature to do? I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but I don't want to go down this road again if it's not.
Okay. I think from the aspect of we've got the two products that we can look at from the transportation and the corrections area. I think they brought back very similar products in looking at a broad perspective of the various departments and coming back with fairly broad recommendations. And the challenge is to get that next level lower in developing specific recommendations. And there may be some things to do to maybe hone in a little tighter on that, maybe structure the process slightly differently in the future. In all honesty, I always think it's a good idea. And again, I'm coming at it from a biased standpoint, but I think it's a good idea to get a collection of expertise together to take a look at an organization and how it operates. The question literally becomes the depth that that group can achieve in the time frame, the scope, and the level of expertise in that group. Those are the three things that I think you can manipulate, play with, define, that may be able to, you know, get it at a high level or drill down a little further into the organization.
Any questions, Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Okay, Mr. Payne, I do want to say we have representatives from the Department of Corrections here in this. So, Mr. Kane, you can sort of walk us through the report, maybe, and then if we have specific questions of you or DOC, we have a number of people who could probably answer those questions. I don't know how deeply we want to get into their budget because we have to look at the governor's recommendations, and we'll have 2 days coming up to look at their budget. So, Mr. Kane?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N, and I was privileged to be co-chair of the Corrections Strategic Management and Operation Advisory Task Force. As Mr. Peterson pointed out, we met a total of 10 times over 6 months, usually for at least a half a day, sometimes for a full day, Several of our meetings took place at state correctional institutions. The task force was made up from a wide variety of people, strategic management, academia, law enforcement, community services, and others. I think that I can speak for everybody in saying that we were honored to be appointed to the task force and took our work very, very seriously. We came up with a number of findings and conclusions, and they're summarized in the executive report. And with your permission, I would go through those, and there's rationale and source material later in the report that we can go through, or you can simply ask questions. But our charge was to look at an analysis of staffing, administration of prisons, central office, administrative service staffing, operations, the impact of decisions on other agency budgets, offender treatment and programming, field services, pension plans, short-term offenders and probation violators, offender health care, juvenile services, and the conditional release and challenge incarceration programs. It's a broad charge, and it was, I will tell you that our recommendations do not include recommendations on all these things for two reasons. One, we had a limited time to go into things, and as Mr. Peterson pointed out, the depth to which we could go into things was also somewhat limited. And the other reason is that given the specificity of some of the things that we were told to look at, the makeup of the committee was not necessarily, did not necessarily lend itself to real thorough kinds of recommendations. So there are some things on there that we did not necessarily make recommendations on. But our summary findings, as I said, is pointed out on page one of the executive summary. First off, we know in this extreme budget crisis that we have that the goal is to find savings. And we found savings, but I need to be real upfront at the beginning and say that we didn't find monumental savings in the short term. We have some recommendations that save money immediately, but we have others that are slower to pay back and in some cases require or would require an investment up front to get a return. And I know that there's danger in saying that right out of the box, but I think that I need to tell you that our expectations were to try and find a lot of money and efficiencies, and frankly, we were pleased with the fact that we believe that the department is running fairly lean and mean right now. We believe that the department has good management and efficient operations upon which to improve, to build on improvements. Again, the opportunities for long-term savings are cost avoidance, and really we're talking about future costs, may require some investments in the short term to ensure successful implementation and long-term savings. We found that multiple calculation of per diems was confusing and sometimes lent itself to selective interpretation. And I say that rather than use the word manipulation because I don't want to talk about people's motives. But there, you know, when you're looking for a per diem, you're looking for a simple evaluation of what it costs per inmate to, you know, to operate the corrections department. And corrections is in a position where they have three different positions, some of which are three different per diems, one of which at least is legislatively mandated, and the other two have utility in different arenas. We recommend, and one of our first recommendations, and I'll get to it in a moment when we get to strategies, is to whittle that down to one easily understood per diem, and our recommendation would be that that be the operational per diem. But again, I'll get to that momentarily.
Mr. King, can you just hold, just hold off, Mr. Carter? Could maybe you give us a little history since you've been around for a lot of these per diem discussions. Just give us a little history of the three per diems that Mr. Kane's talking about. And then maybe if you know the answer regarding how other states compute that, because that is always the debate here, is how do we measure up vis-a-vis other departments of correction, state departments of corrections.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, the per diem issue is a very complicated issue, and we'll get into that a little more. But right now, there are three basic per diems. There is the operating per diem, which we see in the budget books, and that's, you know, what the total cost is for that, the institution for housing an inmate. You know, it includes their food, their medical, the correctional officer salaries. Then they have the marginal per diem. This is what we use for fiscal notes when we're adding new beds. Well, some of the costs, you know, they do not need a new warden, or the heating costs will stay the same, so the marginal per diem is going to be a little less than the operating per diem. Then we have in statute, too, that they have to include not only the operating per diem, but in statute it says they should include the central office expenses and also capital costs, such as, you know, if they're bonding and, debt services for that. And we've usually, what we've required and what we've figured out is that I think 65% of the central office costs are attributed to institutions. Now, a little history of this. That statute, I think, took place. It was a senator Senator Kelly that included this. I think it was in the latter 90s, because he felt that, you know, the legislature was not getting the complete, you know, costs for corrections. It also, when you look at some of the reports, too, there's reports out there. They used to have the Corrections Yearbook, which would try to compare costs, and they would look at all states. They would send out a survey, but what they found was that states were doing their per diems differently. So it really now, the Corrections Yearbook, they ceased to exist, about 3 or 4 years ago. However, there are still reports out there that look at per diems. You have one report here, the state, we mentioned this a couple years ago. This is the state prison expenditures. It's a report by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And what they try to do, they try to compare apples to apples. This report is done about every 5 years. We called there, and they said the next report should be coming out either next year or in 2011. What they include in here, though, is they include the operating per diem, they include central office costs, and they include bonding and interest expenses. Now, we also have to do a report for NCSL. So we call corrections and get information on that. What NCSL, National Conference of State Legislators, what they want included is they want the operating per diem and they want the central office expense. They do not ask for the capital expenses. Next, we have a report here. This comes out from the National Association of State Budget Officers. So this is the Department of Finance. People give information on this report. And they do a study. It's an expenditure report on corrections, and they include capital costs. They include the debt services and interest costs. We also have, I think we heard from the Department of Human Services on their sex offender program, and they gave us a sheet, too, that included, you know, their total, what they said was their total per diem, and that per diem included debt services and capital costs, and they depreciate the buildings over 30 years. We also have Representative Coles. Remember, he had the statute that the counties were to look at costs, you know, in the jails, because we kept getting these different numbers, and they tried to do an average per diem, you know, come up with what would be an average per diem that the sort of like procedures and policies that the jails would use, and I believe they included capital costs in that per diem. So, Mr. Chair, that is just a little, highlight on the per diem. Once again, very complicated.
And, Mr. King, what are you recommending?
That it be simplified, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think Mr. Carter represented it very well. If you could follow the entire conversation and see the multiple ways that things get measured, it demonstrates the problem. And our recommendation was that our recommendation is that we find some way to simplify it, and I'll get into specifics later, and make it so that you legislators and the taxpayers that you represent can understand it. If you turn to page 15 in the report, you can see an example. There are the three per diems over the past 10 years. And again, you see the statutory per diem goes up in years when we have higher capital expenditures and down when we don't, the operating per diem, and then the marginal per diem. And, you know, even with those three, notwithstanding the several others that Mr. Carger talked about, it becomes very confusing to determine what it costs to keep somebody in one of our institutions. Moving on to page 2 of the executive report, we believe that evidence-based practices should be supported. And, you know, this is something that, we've come a long way in determining what makes a difference in the services that you provide that would lower recidivism in the institutions. There's a wealth of research out there from Canada and the United States that didn't exist several years back. The department is using evidence-based practices where it's appropriate. You'll be getting a report from Grant Dewey of the department on the effects of the MCORP project, as well as a report on evidence-based practices from another group later on. We've found a great deal of promise in that. In fact, in Mr. Dewey's report, I believe that one set of practices, when consistent from institutionalization into the community, reduces recidivism by as much as 37%. So we recommend that they should be supported moving forward. That efforts that have been made in investments in prisoner reentry have shown promising returns in terms of public safety and cost savings, and we caution against reductions in those programs, even though in times of tight budgets that may be a temptation.
Mr. Dan, yes. I understand the promising practices with reentry. Is that is your assessment based on MCOR and the Network in Minnesota programs, or national research?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's based primarily on MCOR. The evaluations of the other programs, it's not complete, but based upon the MCORP report, which was very thorough, we're finding some very promising returns.
Very good.
We talked in depth about the three delivery systems that make up Minnesota's corrections and how that can be a contributor towards inconsistency and confusion, although we recognize that changing that at this time would be costly, and we make no recommendation to that regard. We recommend that we focus on sustaining collaboration between jurisdictions and finding standards. We recommend we have old prisons in Minnesota. Of the 8 adult prisons, I believe 7 of them are older than 30 years. One of them I know is older than 100 years. Another one, if it's not over 100 years, it's rapidly approaching it. And that there is a tremendous inefficiency in terms of energy, in heat, electricity, and other things in at least one of the prisons that we visited, and that an investment there would be one that would pay itself back long term. And we recommend changes to offender health care that we believe will improve outcomes, save tax dollars, and increase efficiency.
Mr. Cannon, are you going to go through these?
Yeah, I'm going to go through the strategies and the recommendations, and then
because we're going through them real fast here. Are we going to have time then go back and then talk about them?
Because these are just summary findings. I'll get into them a little bit deeper now, if that's okay, Mr.
Very Chair. Good. Thank you.
Next, we move to strategies and recommendations, number 2. Strategy number one is to assure the sound use of sound financial principles in prison cost reporting, the per diem issue. And we recommend, with all due respect to Senator Kelly, repeal of the statutory per diem. And that the state should use the operational per diem, perhaps with some modifications, to do its measurement on prison costs. And that DOC should continue to report on capital expenditures and apportion costs for support services. Now, in looking at the statutory per diem, as we looked earlier, you have a wide variation in terms of where that goes, at least in part due to the fact that capital expenditures need to be recognized in the year that they're made. Normal and customary accounting practices and budgeting practices typically take a capital expenditure and depreciate it over its useful life. So if you make improvements, as Mr. Carger said, you have a prison, you build a prison, you depreciate the construction of that prison over 30 years. If you do improvements like with things like windows, you might depreciate them over 15 years. If you purchase a large number of computers, you might depreciate them over 5 years. There's a table that's used. We believe that's a more accurate way of projecting costs. But we also are of the opinion that per diems in and of themselves are not a real good measure of outcomes or efficiency. That probably a more efficient measure is the cost per taxpayer for correctional services in the state when comparing across states. Because we operate fewer prisons and have fewer people in prison than a lot of other states. If you wanted to lower per diems, there are two very quick ways to lower per diems. One is to cut services, because security is a necessary requirement, so you can cut services, but in that case, you jeopardize outcomes and you jeopardize recidivism in the future, if you believe the report that Mr. Dewey is going to deliver. The other way is to have more people in prison. I mean, because as Mr. Carger pointed out, you have fixed costs. You have the cost of the building, you have the cost of the heat, the electricity, you have the cost of the warden and most of the staff. Well, if you double up everybody in prison, you know, you'll lower the per diem, but your actual correctional costs will go up considerably, as well as the safety would go down considerably. So again, we're of the opinion as a group that per diems are not the most effective way to measure efficiency.
Mr. Kane, the problem we have, though, and Mr. Carger, I don't know if you can help here, I mean, but if I would be fine with having one per diem that we all understand, and I'm just concerned, you know, because I do think that, at least since I've been in the legislature, every Republican, Democrat is always asking, you know, what other states do. I mean, we're trying to always compare ourselves and not just trying to do things on the cheap, but, you know, how do we enhance public safety but do it in a cost-effective way? That's our responsibility here. So if we can't compare ourselves to other states, are we going to be an island unto ourselves? You know, if we're going to make a significant change, I want to make sure that it's consistent with what's happening nationally. So does your recommendation fit with the Bureau, what the Bureau of Justice is going to do with this analysis, or...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know the answer to that because we didn't speak to the Bureau of Justice or the Bureau of Justice Statistics. We in Minnesota have a total of 9,600 adult inmates in our state prison system. You can take a state like Texas that has 60,000, or California, which has somewhere in the same range, and you know you're spreading costs across the number of inmates that you have. If you have fixed costs and they don't change by adding numbers of inmates, Minnesota's by virtue of the fact that we have fewer inmates, are going to be higher. On the other hand, you can measure the cost per taxpayer of correctional services, and comparing that in to other states, I think you, I mean, if you just measure our per diem, you'll find that our per diems are probably, because of the economies of scale that we lack, are not going to compare well with states that imprison large numbers of inmates. But if you compare the cost of correctional services, we compare very well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say thank you before I ask you hard questions. It's my understanding that you volunteered your time, and we really do appreciate that you took that time. And then I want to express a little bit of frustration, because I was hoping that we were going to get some strong reform recommendations. We are facing a large budget deficit, and we're going to have to figure out where to cut, and I was actually hoping we were going to get some recommendations along that line. But the per diem issue is an issue that I've worked on for many years, and it's grown to be near and dear to my heart. Can you answer this question? Was the task force, was it ever brought to your attention that the Department of Corrections essentially tells the counties to calculate the per diem in the manner in which they're asking, or you're asking for it to be repealed? And did they tell you that the sex offender program also reports the way that you're asking us to eliminate?
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, no. We did not have that discussion. We didn't talk about it at all.
Okay. And this might not be the right answer. You might not be the right person to answer this. Maybe Mr. Debo might be the proper person. But Mr. Debo, it states in, and we've been told over and over from the Department of Corrections, that they have to claim all of the capital costs and that it's claimed in per diem in the first year. Can you tell me where in the statute it says that they have to claim all of the capital costs in 1 year rather than depreciating it over 30 years like the department, the sex offender program does? I don't believe it's anywhere in the statute.
Who were you asking that question?
Probably not them. Probably Mr. Debo. Could maybe Gary.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Carter.
You have to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I believe the statute just says that they have to calculate the capital cost. It does not say how they have to do it. I think, like we have here from information from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, we can share this with members too. One of the members gave this to me. And it was a discussion with their bonding expert, and where they were saying, where they discussed this with the bonding expert from the Department of Finance. And the Department of Finance, they came up with a recommendation for their facilities, they would depreciate them over 30 years.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So those are my concerns with this recommendation, and I did warn the presenter that I would be asking these questions about per diem, because frankly I don't think we should be eliminating these. I think it is important that we have one per diem, and that's why we put it in statute. So we do have one. We have one statutory per diem that we all can use to find out how much it really does cost. Because if we were only comparing the marginal cost, we would not be getting an accurate picture of what it really does cost to build a new prison, or to shut one down in the event that that happened, or to replace one in the event we had a catastrophic event. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kane, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, I would ask Assistant Commissioner to come and help answer that question.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. and Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I'm rereading the statutory per diem, just as Representative Hilstrom was saying, and we took it quite literally when it said, it says in there, appropriate percentage of capital costs. And so to us, that meant capital expenditures. And we only get that reported to us from the Department of Administration once per year. So when this statutory language became effective, that's what we did. Yes, DHS, their MSOP, does do depreciation. Actually, I believe all of state-operated services does. And we contacted them to see how they are doing that, because we know that this has been an issue that's been near and dear to many people's hearts. The Department of Administration for many years did the depreciation for DHS, because they, by statute, have to charge the counties. Excuse me. And part of what they charge the counties is that depreciation. So years ago, the Department of Administration had a system set up where they have been tracking all of their capital expenditures and doing depreciation. Several years ago, they turned the system over to DHS, and they have continued to keep this system in place. We've never had such a system. We don't have our buildings, all the betterments, all that kind of information in any type of system. It doesn't exist right now. And so we would have to go and try to collect all that data. Several of our buildings, as you know, are past their useful life, being 120 years old and 100 years old. But we would have to go in and redo all of that. We don't, A, have the system, and to be perfectly honest, we don't really have the staff right now to be able to go ahead and rebuild all that information either.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can sympathize that you don't have the staff to do it, but I'm looking for a potential solution for you, and I don't want to repeal the statutory per diem. I think that we need to have an accurate reflection. So I guess it's probably a choice then for the department whether they choose to depreciate it over 30 years. So it's a policy within your own department rather than a statutory mandate that you aren't permitted. And would that be an accurate depiction of what you just said?
Ms. Cornelius.
Madam Chair, I guess it's sometimes even statutory language is up for interpretation, and to us when it says report capital cost, we are reporting capital costs, and I guess the manner, I guess I would prefer that the statutory language be clarified then, because as I read it, it says to report your capital costs, and those are our capital costs.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, perhaps a language change that suggests that you report capital costs depreciated over the useful life of the investment would be a more accurate replication. We felt that it really was not an accurate description of what costs are when you're recognizing capital investments all in the year that they're made, because things do have a useful life. And I can tell you, as operating a community program, we have a depreciation schedule where, you know, if you buy something, you don't necessarily recognize it when you buy it. You might recognize one-fifth of it when you buy it, and one-fifth the next year, and the next year, and after 5 years, you assume that it's exceeded its life. And that would be a much more accurate way to depict this. And it sounds to me like this is what the Department of Human Services does. I'll move on if there's no more questions.
Okay. Yeah, any other questions on per diem?
In strategy two, we recommend that the state continue to invest in reentry strategies. Recommendation 2.1 is a recommendation that the department should convene a cross-entity task force to increase consistency of revocation guidelines, policies, and practices related to technical violations in supervised release cases, and to do so without compromising public safety. I know that technical violations have been an interest to this committee and the Senate committee in the past. What we found was that the Department of Corrections has guidelines for how they will handle technical violations in their HRU, but in order for a technical violation to take place or to have those guidelines applied, it actually has to get to the Department of Corrections. And while the department has guidelines, there generally are not guidelines within counties, and certainly not across counties, where it says this person gets referred back to the department, this person gets restructured in the community. So consequently, you may have a situation where even within a single county, one supervising agent refers any violation back to the Department of Corrections for evaluation under their guidelines, and a technical violation, and another supervising agent may in fact send nobody back because he works closer with the client and understands the resources in the community. We recommend that that be standardized across the three delivery systems. Recommendation 2.2 recommends that no person should be committed to the commission.
Mr. Kane, how would you do that?
I would get together a committee of those counties that do their own county supervision, the MAC Act counties, and those counties that are represented by the Department of Corrections, and I would basically charge them with developing standardized procedures.
And what might those procedures look like? Just because some of this is so subjective to the case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they might look similar to the guidelines situation, wherein counties might agree that for a single dirty UA, sending someone back to the Department of Corrections might not be the first response. There might be another response, again, depending upon resources in the community. And for failure to report to your supervising agent, there'd be different guidelines. But the technical violations are violations that do not involve conviction of a new crime, and we believe that they should be standardized across the state to the extent possible.
And does the department agree with this recommendation?
They did.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
The next recommendation, recommendation 2.2, is an interesting one. We recommend that nobody should be committed to the Commissioner of Corrections for less than 30 days to serve, except individuals subject to certain predatory offender statutes. In looking at people who are sent to prison for the first time on a particular conviction, over a six-month period, we found that there were 100 people that went to prison for less than 30 days. And 85 of those people went for less than 15 days, and 37 people went for one day. And we found it very inefficient to send somebody to prison for one day. The way that this happens generally is you have someone who receives a probationary sentence with a term of local confinement. So, for instance, someone gets a 24-month sentence and is sentenced to serve the first year in the workhouse or the county jail. So they serve a year in the county jail, and now they come out and they continue to be on probation. Well, they do something like have a dirty UA. The county continues to keep them in the community but imposes another term of incarceration, say another 30 days or another 60 days, to give them consequences for that dirty UA. Well, because of the way sentences are set up, and hopefully this is making sense, on that 24-month sentence, an offender has 16 months to serve, two-thirds in, one-third out. Eventually, you get to the point where sending to prison is counterproductive because you have very little time left for them to do in prison. And as I said, in some cases, as little as one day. Now, how does that come about, you might ask yourself? Well, it might come about because the judge just finally gets tired of sending him to the workhouse and says, fine, I'm sending you to prison, even though it's for the last 30 days. It might come about because the offender asks that their sentence be executed, because they may have that 24-month sentence if it's executed, but they may have a 5-year probationary sentence. So if, in fact, they request that the sentence be executed, now they fall under that two-thirds, one-third scenario, and they have less time to serve on supervision. I'm not sure why all the reasons are why someone would go to prison the first time, but I can tell you that it's tremendously expensive to take a trooper and have them drive someone in an insecure setting to prison, to have them serve one day, to process them into the institution, and then to prepare a discharge process for them as well. It would be better served to keep those people in the community. And everyone agrees with that. Not everyone agrees with the costs. We went further in that recommendation because we're very sensitive to the area of transferring costs to counties and recommend that where possible, house arrest with offender paid consequences be used instead of sending them back to prison for 30 days. But the hard and fast recommendation is that no one should go to prison for the first time for less than 30 days. And we're well aware that, you know, that may result in people being violated at 31 days because sometimes that's the way the system reacts. But somewhere that has to stop. That's our recommendation. We recommend under recommendation 2.3 that financial resources generated by MinCor Industries should be reinvested in MinCor to reduce inmate idleness, grow the business, and support reentry programs. When MinCor first started, it had to be subsidized by the state. It's now self-sufficient. Last year, the state took $2 million for the general fund. We understand the tendency to do that in tough financial times, but we believe that MinCor funds could better be invested by creating more job training programs that are transferable to the community, by reducing inmate idleness, because inmate idleness becomes a public safety issue, and that to the extent possible in today's financially difficult times, that those funds, where possible, should be reinvested. We recommend that the legislature should support affordable, supportive housing for hard-to-place offenders. And that housing, where possible, should be built by offender work crews. Housing and employment are one of the biggest impediments to successful reentry. We believe that should be addressed. We recommend that the MinCor program should be expanded from the three pilot areas where it's currently being operated, Ramsey County, Hennepin County, and the DFO counties. And we recommend that the early release programs that are currently in place, the challenge incarceration program and the conditional release program, should be evaluated to determine if they can be expanded without compromising public safety, and just as important, without compromising program integrity. Both programs, particularly CIP, have shown great promise, but there's a concern that, you know, we're not sure if the promise is related to the selective process for who is eligible, for the small number of people who are in the program, or to the services. So consequently, expanding it, we're concerned, without first learning those answers to those questions, could compromise the program's effectiveness.
Mr. King, the early release program, that's the task force's recommendations. Did DOC agree with this?
Yes.
They did.
So that it be evaluated to determine if it could be expanded.
And who would evaluate it?
Our recommendation would be that the DOC evaluate it. That's the recommendation of the task force.
Maybe I missed something last year, but it seems like whenever that idea came up, it was roundly criticized and shot down by the Department of Corrections. Did I miss that somewhere?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that.
Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Crist, did I miss something last year? Or was, I could have. It was tense.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Crist. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division. Mr. Chair, I think you got it right. However, we have expanded the CIP program. There are new criteria for that program. There are now upwards of 170 participants in that program at Willow River right now. And the women's program at Togo is full at 24, and we're in the process of adding some bunks to that program to expand it to 30. So We did listen to the legislature there. We have found a way to expand the population of those programs under the new criteria. The CRP program is not being expanded at this point. We still feel that a number of the applicants to that program are not just drug addicts who need treatment in order to be released, but a number of those participants were actively involved in selling drugs for profit or had weapons on their persons or very close by to protect their criminal enterprise. And we feel that that group of offenders is still a danger to public safety, and so we haven't expanded that program.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom and then Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, I read the recommendation that the DOC should do the analysis of expansion so that legislators like me don't come in with bills to expand it without their consent. So I do have a question of you, Mr. Kane. Do you think that it was appropriate to have the commissioner participate in the task force, or would it have been better to simply have had the commissioner and her staff available to provide information? And the reason I'm asking that question is because what I really want to know is, did the commissioner or their staff ever blame the legislature for their perceived problems at DOC during this process, and in particular related to the Challenge Incarceration Program?
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, members of the committee, the task force was very aware that by having the commissioner on the task force and by relying heavily on DOC information in making calculations, that we could cross over into an area where the tail wags the dog. And we were cautious not to go there. I think that the commissioner's involvement on the task force, while I'm not really sure whether or not I think it was valuable, but I think that the task force challenged her on some of her positions, and she certainly challenged the task force on some others. Some, as in any kind of discourse, some went her way, some went the other way. So it really, we were very cautious that we not be in a position where the department dictated our recommendations. In terms of, did anyone ever blame the legislature? I don't think that there was ever any discussion that, you know, that placed a value judgment on things that happened. I think that there probably were side discussions that suggested an element of frustration that that sometimes the legislature is in a position where they might not understand or take into consideration all the nuances of a decision. For example, a decision to simply expand the Challenge Incarceration Program without knowing whether that expansion might compromise the effectiveness of the program as it now stands, and perhaps the reasons why that might be was frustrating, I think, to some people. But I don't recall any open discussion where the legislature was blamed for anything.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I perfectly understood what I was doing and the consequences, and the idea that the department would go to the task force and have side conversations implying that I didn't know what I was doing or what the consequences were is pretty appalling as far as I'm concerned. So, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kane.
I would not characterize any conversation that I overheard to be personal or to say that that you didn't understand things. I mean, it wasn't like that.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, I want to go back to the recommendation 2.3 on MinCorp. I remember it was quite a few years ago now when MinCorp was a subsidized program, and there was a pretty significant effort to get it off a dead center and have it actually become an entrepreneurial enterprise. So it's good to see that it's generating income, it's generating its own resources. My question is some money was taken out of those resources in MinCorp, and your suggestion is that it be used to actually expand the impact of MinCorp, which I think is a good idea. But the question I have is what traditionally has been happening to the money generated by MinCorp that's in excess of their operational needs?
I ask for
Assistant Commissioner Christ.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the MinCorp money by statute first has to be set aside 6 months of operating investment to get them through the peaks and the valleys of a normal market. So we do that first. And then they set aside a certain portion of their funds every year in order to reinvest back into the business, to buy more machines so that they can go into a different market segment to replace old machines. Some of the machines, for instance, at the Stillwater facility date back to World War II. And we're trying to find more modern ways to do the business more effectively and make more money. Now, once we get past the investment back into the program itself, then we are putting money into education programs. We buttress some vocational programs in the Department of Corrections. With that, we are spending money on reentry programs. For instance, there is a $200,000 investment for the biennium in reentry program in the Bemidji area for Native American offenders that are going back into that area to serve the three counties up in that area. And that's the kind of thing that we're investing in. I can get you more detail, but that's what I've got off the top of my head.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, just one comment, and I guess I'm not either speaking for or against it, but so basically what in excess of kind of the things that are required by this by statute, the DOC just has the discretion to spend that money basically on other things as it sees appropriate. Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, there's a statute that speaks directly to the discretion that we've got. To paraphrase it to the best of my memory, it allows us to reinvest back in the business and to put money into education and to reentry programs.
Just so the committee knows, at least the Finance Division, that the governor is recommending that we transfer in 2010 $574,000 out of MinCorp and $989,000 in 2011 into the general fund. So it sort of differs with your recommendations, Mr. Kane, but the committee will have to decide whether that's a good or a bad thing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Just one last question for Mr. Chris. I believe that there is an amount per hour that's set aside from the wages of the offenders. And I want to say, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I want to say it was like $1 million. And then that the department chose to reinvest that money or give that back to MinCorp. But that is within the discretion of the department as to whether or not they choose to do that as well. Is that correct?
Commissioner Chris.
Madam Chair, members, there's a small group of inmates within the MinCorp enterprise who are building products that are sold on the interstate market. According to a federal law, we've got to pay those offenders a prevailing wage for their labor so as not to undercut workers in the free world on those products. we do have the discretion then to charge those offenders back under that law, I believe. I think that it's that law that authorizes it. We've got the discretion to charge back those offenders room and board, if you will. And we do so, and we reinvest that room and board money back into MnCorp.
When you're in the joint.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. I believe it was about $1 million last year, or maybe the last biennium. I can't remember exactly the amount.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, Ms. Cornelius is indicating about 3 years ago it was that amount of money.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Continue, Mr. Kane.
Strategy three, we recommend the expanded use of evidence-based practices to improve public safety and correctional outcomes. We recommend that the Department of Corrections focus training on evidence-based practices so that there's broader use at all staff levels. We recommend that they collaborate with the education community, the criminal justice system, and professional organizations to develop a post-secondary level training in corrections evidence-based practices. We recommend that the DOC find additional funding to expand the court service tracking system to include the use of electronic case plans beyond their pilot use in the CIP program. And we recommend that the state higher education system should partner in conducting ongoing EBT research training and curriculum development. And again, this is an area where we recommend consistency across the state's three delivery systems. In strategy four, we recommend expansion of collaboration with communities that where possible, the DOC should continue and increase the use of county jails for additional bed space. That would benefit the Department of Corrections in terms of bed needs, and some counties have excess bed space. We saw that as a benefit to them. Supervision should remain a priority. State and local corrections departments should continue to work closely together to implement evidence-based practices statewide. The DOC should work with county facilities to share formularies to reduce costs. This is basically a recommendation for counties. The legislature allowed the department to share its formulary for medication and its bulk purchasing benefits with counties if they chose to take advantage of it. A lot of counties, in fact, most counties have not. We believe that that would be cost savings to counties. And the state and local corrections agencies should develop and pilot an earned credit compliance program. Again, as I said, the evidence-based practices research has shown a great deal of promise. We're suggesting that as an incentive for taking advantage of evidence-based practice interventions, there be an earned credit that gets developed that people can do things to perhaps reduce their supervision time or get an early discharge for those offenders that participate. In strategy five, we recommend...
And we have a number of questions here.
Sorry.
I think you've hit on some things. Just a quick thing on the county jails that I... What do you actually... I mean, obviously there is space in our county jails, again, through probably a lack of very good planning that... seems to occur in this state. We have excess space in our county jails. What are you suggesting for short-term offenders? Are we resurrecting that? Are we looking at revocation centers? Be more specific about how we might use county jails.
Mr. Chair, the term short-term offenders causes people to pull out crosses and say, please don't talk about that, and I understand that. And we did not get to that level of detail, but we felt like if there's an empty bed in a county jail, that rather than build a bed or expand something in prison, that efforts should be made by the department to find ways to more effectively collaborate and make use of that bed by department offenders.
So you don't have any specifics?
No.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you. Just as a comment, I don't think it was for the short-term offender program. I don't think it was that the counties cared that they had the prisoners. They just wanted to be paid the proper amount. The question I have is, when you talked about the, I don't know what's going on out there, earned credit compliance program, is that on top of the, you know, we already do the two-thirds in, one-third out kind of deal. Is that on top of that, too?
Mr. Kane.
I mean, as far as getting, so it'd be less than two-thirds is what I'm trying to say.
Representative Bigham, members of the committee, we're talking primarily here, I believe, about probation offenders.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was this another one of the recommendations that the department agreed on? Or and maybe this, are all of these something that DOC agreed on? Or is this something that some of them are DOC's and some of them are yours?
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom, Chair. We operated on a consensus strategy, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't recall that we were ever in a position where people were asked to say, I endorse that or I don't endorse it. So my conclusion is that since we heard no strong objections from the Department of Corrections, that this is something that they agree with.
Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to know if the governor would also think that that was a good idea. So, but he wasn't in the room.
All right, let's go on. Mr. Kane.
Increase the efficiency of the DOC health system. There are, part of the direction we were given, and certainly one of the areas of challenge is in the geriatric offenders or offenders who are non-ambulatory and at least at first blush would tend to seem to no longer pose a public safety risk. And we recommend that the Department of Corrections, the Department of Human Services and Public Safety should explore partnership with skilled nursing facility to increase community-based options for long-term care. There's a number of pitfalls to this recommendation, and we're aware of that. First off, there aren't a lot of local or community long-term care facilities that will take some of the offenders in question. Second, some of the offenders in question, in the department estimates that they could probably find 25 tomorrow and a number of more from other systems. But some of them are offenders who committed high-profile crimes and are still in the memory of the public. So having them go out to a skilled nursing facility would present the political and media problem of looking to be not prudent. The advantage to finding a way to do that, of course, is right now if they're in a correctional facility, they're the sole responsibility of the Minnesota taxpayers. And that remains the case regardless of whether or not they receive their services in the institution they're held, whether or not they have to be transported and served in a private hospital, or whatever. Were we able to establish or create a situation where they could be reasonably treated in the community with adequate custody and other things, those costs would in many cases be borne by Medicare and Medicaid and result in a relatively huge saving per offender. We believe that the DOC should enhance its healthcare service delivery model, and we have some specific recommendations later on about that that relate to telemedicine, technology, perhaps doing evaluations much the same way that we conduct hearings with face-to-face computer monitors. And we recommend that there should be standardization of health care supplies, not just medications. Things like bandages, other health care type things that should be bought in bulk, inventoried, kept in storage, and dispersed throughout the institution health care facilities. We believe that in strategy six, and there are some pictures in here.
Mr. Kane, we need to go back. We have a couple questions on strategy five. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, as part of your discussions regarding corrections and geriatric patients, did the Department of Corrections bring to your attention the 1996 report recommending where a possible starting point for looking at the issue, because this was studied in 1996?
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I've not seen that, no.
Okay. And thank you. And then regarding the telemedicine, did you ever seek out data on how many states use telemedicine? Because it's my understanding that 36 states already use telemedicine, and Minnesota isn't one of them.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we did not receive that information.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Kane, back to the health care issue. I thought that the legislature had said that we did not want the dental care program at DOC cut. I can't remember exactly which part of the program that was cut. It wasn't just preventative care, but it was the next step up. Mr. Carter, do you remember what program was cut from the dental program at DOC? Do you remember which part that the department had originally requested?
Mr. Chair, I believe their request in the governor's budget was to reduce dental care, and I think it was some of the preventive dental care, which would save I don't know how many positions, but it would save.
That was not in a budget, and it ended up getting cut anyway. Did any of that discussion come up around health care costs?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we did not specifically discuss dental care.
All right. Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, can you tell me, going back to the geriatric problem as well of geriatric offenders, can you tell me, did the committee look at other options, any other options besides private-public partnership?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, no, we did not.
Mr. Chair, can I just, Mr. Kane, I have talked with a member of the governor's staff, Crystal Forrest. I've talked with Commissioner Fabian, and I would like the task force, or as you move forward on the geriatric, and as you indicated, there are problems with the private skilled nursing facilities taking these folks, and it's yet very costly to continue to keep them in our system. One of the options might be to look at vacant or unused facilities in the state that are publicly owned already and put in a secured nursing home facility for these patients. So as you move forward with this this idea or this recommendation, I will hope that the task force looks at that as a possibility to use facilities that we already currently have in the state to maybe put to look at a secured nursing home facility, being fiscally wise and fiscally responsible, yet provide services that are needed for those folks.
Representative Ward, I believe that the task force's responsibilities will cease to exist after today, as far as I know.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that we're continuing to exist till June, but I don't believe we have any further meetings planned.
All right. Very good. We have two more questions. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, I was trying to find anywhere in here where you address an issue that I keep hearing about, and that's the lack of sufficient mental health treatment or addiction treatment. And it seems like something needs to go into that, and there's nothing whatsoever that I can find here. Is there been any thoughts about how we can improve that and also work with outside sources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, we became aware of the fact that of the inmates that are determined to need substance abuse treatment, that that not all of them get it. In fact, that a relatively small percentage of them get it. And that was identified as primarily a fiscal problem. I think that the department would want to have more treatment available and more coordination perhaps with the Department of Human Services for those people who then complete treatment and then go into the community and need continuing care. But we did not, that was one of the areas that we were not able to delve real deep into. We also talked about the concern with the number of mentally ill inmates who are in prison and the fact that the potential loss of general assistance medical care will compromise their ability to maintain on medications that they've been stabilized on while in the institution once they're released. And we, you know, that was something that we talked about getting into the report. I'm not sure that it necessarily got in there, but that the state should be concerned with if they don't have a mechanism to maintain themselves on medication, one could reasonably expect that they might decompensate and in the best case scenario commit nuisance crimes which might result in their revocation. In the worst case scenario, commit more serious crimes.
Jim Murray.
Mr. Chair, I don't know where to go. I just think it's something that certainly should have been looked at and some planning done for it. I guess it wasn't.
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, this may be a question for you and Chair Hillstrom or else for the department. Is the department going to bring forth specific recommendations in the department bill? Has there been any discussion about that after this report or any other discussion in the interim?
Assistant Commissioner Christ, I don't. Are you? What are you doing with? Or what are you going to do with this task force recommendation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, we're evaluating the report carefully. We've already started to take some steps on certain items in the report. For instance, the next recommendation has to do with energy savings. We're working on things like that. We've not yet contemplated coming forward with any legislation related to the report, but we certainly do anticipate that our policy and fiscal committees might have ideas along those lines.
So, Bigham.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and I don't know what Representative Cornish is going to be saying here after me, I take it, but there's a lot of this stuff that I think we already knew. And I just am a tad bit disappointed that there isn't more. I'm not saying you, sir, and I appreciate you and all the volunteers and their opinion and the time and the effort that went in the report. But a little bit more specifics, I think, coming from corrections, because I think that was a big discussion last year that bipartisanly on this committee and on Chair Hillstrom's committee that we had more efficiencies and room to streamline things. And I think that I just was hoping for more specifics. I'm really interested in the healthcare, in the standardized healthcare supplies. I'm a little bit surprised that in this day and age we aren't doing that when a big bulk of the department's costs when it comes to the inmates is the healthcare and the services. So I think that this is a good starting point, but I would hope that as a committee we can either come together with some bipartisan ideas to put forth to the department in legislation, or that maybe the department would come up with some specifics that we can do for efficiencies after the last 2 years of discussing this with them.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just a short comment. I'm not enlightened from the report, and I'm kind of disappointed there wasn't more specifics that I think most of the stuff we could have got from other states or from NCSL or other documents. And I was looking, and I was wondering if there's some kind of communication breakdown of what our message was to the task force, because it's a study more than it is a solution. And so I was kind of disappointed, not in the folks, they did a lot of hard work, but I can't take this and then glean things that, okay, Department of Corrections needs to do this now. I think they're going to kind of flounder after this.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, my question relates to Recommendation 2.2. Would you recite the statistics that you had relating to the 100 offenders who were sent for those short-term stays?
Out of the 100, you had like a certain number that spent one day?
Representative Lesh, out of that, as my recollection of those 100 people that were there for less than 30 days, 37 of them were there for one day.
Okay.
Mr. Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane, I can't figure out under the law of averages how that's even possible unless someone has some transportation scam going for kickbacks or something. How are people waiting to the very end to send these guys, or it would seem that they'd be distributed over a longer period of this just one day rather than a huge percentage of going for just one day? Is there something that I'm missing in that?
Ms. Cornelius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the number of admissions, the chart in that document shows the number of admissions. The number of people who actually showed up at prison for one day were 7 for one day, and then it goes down per day by that. And I think what happens is when the offender's going through the system, when they calculate the amount of time they served in county jail, they might just have that one day left. There's also issues with probation, revocation, those types of things. And maybe if somebody sat in county jail over the weekend until somebody could transport them on Monday. That's anecdotal, but yes, we did in a six-month period have 7 offenders show up with one day to serve.
Okay.
Lesh.
Okay, and again, maybe I still don't just understand this. I expect that people would be burning their time in a local jail until they could be shipped or something like that, but still, it still doesn't make sense to me, so I'm probably going to have further conversations about this, about why people are waiting to the end to do that, why jails are.
We have 2 more questions, and then I think we're going to need to adjourn, give Mr. Kane some last word, Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the department. So if the legislature were to take this report and come up with some legislation, for example, on the 30-day issue, would you anticipate that you would be coming and testifying in opposition, or do you think you would be actively supporting something like that? Because I don't know that anybody wants to take on that issue if they don't have the support of the department.
Ms. Cornelius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hailstrom, on the 30-day issue, we would fully support that. It is fairly staff-intensive to do intake for us. The savings for the department is not huge because it's a certain number of offenders coming in for a very, very short time frame. We estimate there might be about $124,000 in bed savings. But it will save some staff time, and it'll allow them to be more efficient with the other offenders who are coming in for longer periods.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kane, since research is showing the importance of reentry and several of us are looking for money, why is it seems like there was a lot of money just sitting there that wasn't being used for that, that is in essence designated for that from MnCorp or things like that?
Mr. Kane, I don't know if that was from MnCorp. From MCOR, you mean?
Oh, was it?
So the reentry program is MCOR. MnCorp is the business for.
Right, but don't. I thought they had extra money in MnCorp that could be used. For
Mr. Kane?
Is that wrong?
Representative Mallory, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the state took $2 million from MnCorp last year for the general fund, so excesses were taken back.
Mr. Kane, I want to give you the last word, but I do want to say, I mean, I know this is probably difficult, and I hope you appreciate some of the frustration of members here, and maybe that was our fault for not being more specific. And Mr. Peterson, maybe in the future we need to focus in on one specific area of a big organization like this rather than saying, go analyze the entire Department of Corrections and come up with recommendations in a short period of time, which I think was unrealistic. Mr. Kane, on behalf of Representative Hillstrom, myself, and our committees, we thank the whole task force for the work that you did. And there are some good recommendations here that need to be fleshed out, and I hope that we can work together with the Department of Corrections in the coming weeks to see if we can't make some of that a reality. Do you have any closing remarks to the committee?
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, the task force, you asked the question early on, you know, the value to the task force. And I think that there's value to these types of things to get a general overview. And as I mentioned earlier when we were speaking, it may appear that the task force has come up with low-hanging fruit, so to speak, that we found things, as Representative Cornish pointed out, that that maybe we could have gleaned from other states. But we were given a very broad charge. And in as I said, we met 10 times over 6 months, probably for a total of pretty close to, you know, 100 hours. And, well, maybe not 100, maybe closer to 50. But, and the makeup of the committee was such that, you know, while we had strategic thinkers that were very familiar with management, they also were participating in discussions on institutional custody status and other things that we, I mean, I think the committee did an admirable job given its time frame, its resources, and its makeup. But if you really wanted to dig deep into an area like you know, one of the areas was administration central office, we looked at that very closely. We determined that the amount of money that's spent on administration compared to the amount of money spent on operations was well within guidelines that we knew to be standard across industries. We looked at the number of people that each manager managed and determined that that was well, and we looked at salaries. But beyond that, to go down and dig deeper would have required people specifically skilled in those areas and told, go do a very deep analysis in this area. Instead, we had people with those skills, but they were said told to go do a broad analysis on a number of areas. I think those of us on the committee are extremely proud of the product that we have, given what we had, but we're also aware of the frustration that the legislature has, and if we were to delve any further into any of these issues, we have some recommendations that I think we could probably reach consensus on about perhaps how that might be structured.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.